The Future Proof Podcast from News Talk.
Proudly supported by Science Foundation Ireland. Hashtag believe in science.
Hello and welcome to Future Proof the Podcast. This is the show where we take a closer look at the world around us. I'm Jonathan McRae. I know we say this every week, but thank you for subscribing, downloading, rating, letting people know about the show. That is, it's really important to us because our audience are our bread and butter, and we do appreciate all of our new listeners. So thanks for joining. Hope you enjoy the show. Coming up on this week's episode, we'll be looking at the modern plight of uncontacted tribes and what we can do to protect them. If you'd like to contact us, you can email us science@newstalk.com. You can find us on Twitter as well. We're at News Talk Science. We get to all of your comments later on in the podcast. First, though, it's time to look back at the week's science news, as we typically do. And of course, a big week for science news. So joining us via Skype is Dr. Shane Bergen from UCD, and from DCU, Dr. Susan Kelleher. You're both very welcome. Our first story is, of course, about the greatest prize of science that everyone moans about, the Nobels. So there are three prizes that we should cover. Having a physicist and a chemist on the program, they didn't want to cover the medicine prize, but I think we probably should. So we'll start with you, Susan. Would you tell us just very briefly why the chemistry peeps got the chemistry prize?
Yeah, so what we need to know is that the body, first of all, knows the difference between left and right molecules. So a molecule can either come in a right-hand molecule or a left-handed molecule.
What does that mean?
And so it basically is the same molecule, but it's a mirror image of itself. So if you were to make a model of, you know, using these kind of a model using balls and sticks to make a molecule that you'd see, if you then just made the mirror image of it, it would look the same, but it would actually react very differently in the body. So one example is the thalidomide story, where the left-handed molecule was fine to take for morning sickness, but the right-handed version of it actually, when it was in the body, caused the birth defects ultimately in the children. That was one of the very first examples where the handedness, as it's called, of a molecule, it was found to be really, really important. So being able to synthesize and make just one version of the molecule is essential. And so the Nobel Prize this year was awarded to Benjamin List and David Macmillan for their work in designing methods to be able to just make one version of these molecules. And the method is called asymmetric organocatalysis. And what it does is it allows people to make just one version of the molecule. So the general route of making these, you'd make both of them and they'd be sort of mixed and very difficult to separate. So their version targets just making one of the handedness. So say there's just a left-hand molecule. And
in that case, you could, something like thalidomide, you could just make the version you want.
Exactly. And that's what they have to do. Then they've realized now with drugs that you actually have to be very careful about the type of molecule that you put in. And so the organocatalysis part of it, is that title in the title, that makes it basically a greener method than would have used before from a catalysis point of view that would have relied on metals and heavy metals. So it speeds up reactions and it makes them greener, and you're able to then actually just make one version of the molecule. So it's really, really clever, and it's sort of part of just the way we do things now, which is brilliant.
Excellently summarized. And that sounds like it should have been a medicine prize, but there was a medicine prize and it wasn't for that.
Yeah, so the thing is that can also be used for loads of different things other than just medicine, but that was obviously one of the main key focuses. The medicine prize itself looked at receptors, so that the receptors in our body that are allow us to detect heat and to feel things. So they, the two awardees were David Julius and Arden Padaputin, and they looked at essentially when you touch something hot, how do you know to pull your hand away? Like, how does the signal get from your hand to your brain to get back to your muscle to pull your hand away? So there are cells in our bodies that have receptors to heat and to touch. So when you touch something hot, they didn't know, you know, they basically, when these buttons are pressed, in those cells, they set off a chain reaction that then causes our body to respond. And we didn't know what those molecules were and those buttons. And so these guys have discovered both of those for heat and for touch. So if you know your skin is being pressed, if you stick your nail into your finger, you can feel that. And that's your body telling you that your cells have been pressed. So they were
I would have thought we would have known that ages ago. Like, these guys are very old.
No, so these guys, this would have been worked on in the 90s and the 2000s, early 2000s. And the reason is we knew there was a signal, but we didn't know the actual molecule. And there were hundreds, if not thousands, of potential molecules in there that did this. And they essentially sifted through it and found the right ones.
Amazing. Shane, the physics prize went to whom and for what, please?
It went to three individuals and it went to them for their work on climate change and advancing our understanding of climate. So the prize is given to three, but it was divided in half. So the first half went to, only physicists could do this. The first half went to Sukiyuru Manabe and Klaus Hasselmann, and they were physically modeling the Earth's climate using, they were quantifying variability, and they were really improving our ability to predict global heating. And the second half of the prize went for a different piece of work by Giorgio Parisi. And his work was on discovering the interplay of disorder and fluctuations in physical systems. And he was looking at how do you find hidden patterns in complex materials. He wasn't working necessarily on climate. He was actually working with a very unusual material called spin glasses. But his work there made it possible to look for patterns within seemingly very complex systems. And that was useful for climate. So I looked up why people are given Nobel Prizes. And it said that they're given to scientists whose work in the previous year has been the greatest benefit to mankind. And I think we've seen in the last year the benefit of having reliable ways to model and understand the effects of climate change on the Earth. And so that's why these three have been awarded the prize in 2021, despite the fact that a lot of this work is old. Some Manabe, who's worked in Princeton, showed a long time ago, decades ago, that the concentration of carbon dioxide can be linked to the temperature on the Earth's surface. Hasselmann then in Max Planck, he went further and was able to show a new method, mathematical, for linking specific events with rises in carbon dioxide. So like the fires this year, for instance, that we could say that has a tangible effect. And the last guy, as I said, in Rome, Paris, he was looking at ways to find order from within disorder. And together their work really has allowed us to understand the nature of the problem of climate change, and understanding the nature of the problem allows us to come up with potential solutions.
Yeah, essentially going from we're doomed to I told you were doomed and here's how I can prove it. Excellent.
Exactly.
Our third story, Susan, has to do with a malaria vaccine and all the talk of course, COVID, which is a hugely pressing and urgent issue. Malaria, of course, kills far more people per year, typically. And this malaria vaccine looks like it may be rolled out in Africa, which could be an absolute game changer.
Yeah, I think the story here is a lot to do with, obviously, this is a solution for people living in areas where malaria is an issue. But the other thing is, you know, the vaccine is only now developed, and it has to be said that this is only because I think the drive wasn't a focus as it is in terms of COVID. So even though it took a long time, it was largely just to do with the fact that there maybe wasn't as people might have seen it as a market for it, different manufacturers, et cetera, and that it wasn't the focus, which is very disappointing. But in any case, it is terrific to have a vaccine rollout now for this. So it's been piloted in three different African countries, and it's shown to, in combination with an antimalarial medication, reduce hospitalizations and death by about 70%. And considering every year around 250 to 300,000 children under the age of 5 die of malaria, it just goes to show how big an impact this is going to be able to make. And it's made by GlaxoSmithKline in the UK. They were the people who were producing it. They're producing it and going to sell it sub-cost price, or just at cost price. So it's sold at cost price. So they're not doing it for profit, which again is one of the reasons perhaps it's taken a while to get to market. The last thing that is really interesting from, like, obviously there's, you know, from a market perspective, from a corporation point of view, a struggle, but also in terms of being able to actually make a vaccine against malaria is quite challenging, because malaria is caused by a parasite that is spread by the biting of female mosquitoes. And so if you think about trying to target the coronavirus, and we're looking at the spike protein, we're trying to just mimic one bit of the virus to be able to then go and produce a vaccine against it. parasites are really complicated and they change all the time. So it's really difficult to actually go in and target something that will be able to longevity, like from a longevity point of view, be able to tackle the parasite, be able to create an immune response against it. So I think it's a huge step and something the World Health Organization is really excited about for all the right reasons.
Shane, our final story has to do with your favorite animals, dogs.
Yes, Jonathan, I think you are a fan too.
I am.
Yes. So this is continued work from that research group in Hungary, who we've talked about before. We really do kind of get a great snapshot of research because we're able to check in with the same research groups at different points in time and show how science sort of evolves and moves on. Previously, we talked about how these clever dogs were able to learn new toys by their owner just saying the word four times, you know, go and get the cup, go and get the cup, etc. And they go and get a cup. But they found in that work that they weren't able to commit it to long-term memory. And so with their cohort of six genius dogs, all of whom are border collies, they said, right, how could we get them to learn things longer term? And so the owners taught the dogs at the beginning, six words a week. And then after that, they built it up to 12 words a week.
Gosh.
And yeah, they found that most of them were able to learn in excess of 100 words. Now, obviously, they can't talk, but they know what, like, to go and get something that corresponds to that word. And they found
God,
that
my
they
children
were...
don't know 100 words, and they're 10 and 6.
Well, this is interesting because they said that the rate of learning was comparable to infants at the age of about 18 months.
Wow.
So I don't know. I think you'd need a child specialist to comment on that. But I think it is fascinating that these dogs can still remember the words 1 to 2 months later. So these are very, very clever boys and girls, little doggies. And it's very interesting. And what I love is that there's no real application to this research. They throw in something at the end saying, oh, it's very important for us to learn how other animals interpret human speech. But I just think they're doing it because they love dogs and it's just a fun thing to do. And you know what? Why not?
Well, from DCU, Dr. Susan Kelleher, from UCD, Dr. Shane Bergen, thanks very much. Now, to many of us, the idea that there could be tribes existing in the world that have had no contact with the outside world seems impossible. But interestingly, there's over 100 uncontacted tribes that we're currently aware of. But are they aware of us? And if so, why do they stay away? Sarah Schenker is Senior Research and Advocacy Officer at Survival International and head of the Uncontacted Tribes campaign. She joins me now. Sarah, what an amazing area of research and work you live in. Tell me a little bit about your role.
Yes, true. It's incredible. I mean, we're here. Survival International has been around for more than 50 years now, working alongside tribal and indigenous peoples to defend their lives and lands. And of course, uncontacted tribes, they're the most vulnerable peoples on the planet. And whilst we can't work directly with them, they are a key part of what we do. They have been since 1969. Without their lands protected, uncontacted tribes just won't survive. But with their lands protected, with their lands intact, they can survive and they can thrive. And it really is, as you say, an extremely important campaign and important thing for people around the world to know about and to be getting involved with. This isn't just a question for a few of us. It really is a question for all humanity.
Talk to me about these tribes that we call uncontacted. Where are they and how do we know they exist?
There are uncontacted tribes in the Amazon rainforest. That's where most of them are. But also in the Chaco forest in Paraguay, on the Andaman Islands in India and in Indonesia and West Papua. And we know that they exist because we have seen aerial photos of them taken from government planes passing overhead during government expeditions to monitor the land and to monitor the well-being of the uncontacted tribes. And also, of course, from accounts that we hear all the time from uncontacted tribes contacted neighbors. So indigenous peoples living in the same region, sometimes in the same territory, kilometers away, but in the same indigenous territory, or sometimes in neighboring indigenous territories. They tell us stories all of the time of their uncontacted relatives or of uncontacted people from different tribes, but who live nearby, and they see their footprints in the forest. Sometimes they see abandoned hunting shelters of the uncontacted tribes, and other key evidence and signs that they're there and that they're moving through their forest, they're using their forest, they're hunting, they're fishing, they're collecting fruits and honey.
It sounds implausible in a way that all the news stories we hear about how these wild spaces are becoming less wild, that every inch of our planet has been explored. It seems crazy to think that there are people who have not. Well, actually, that's my question. What do we mean by uncontacted? Do we mean they have never watched a film, shaken the hand of someone from outside their forest? What do we mean by that?
We mean people who don't have regular contact with outsiders. It doesn't mean they've never had contact with anybody. In fact, in many cases, either those that are alive today or their ancestors would have had contact, including terrible, catastrophic contact and massacres as a result of the invasion of their territories. So it doesn't mean they've never had contact, but they are people who don't have contact with outsiders today and who show very clearly that they don't want that contact. They leave cross spears on forest paths and they point their bows and arrows up towards parting plains. Many of your listeners will also remember the story of the American missionary John Allen Chow, who was killed by uncontacted people on the Andaman Islands. And that is a sign that they clearly don't want outsiders to approach. And that is a result of, as I say, the catastrophic things that they've been through in the past when their territories have been invaded. In many cases, this has left some uncontacted tribes with populations of just one, two, or three people, but who are living on the run and who show that they just want to live in the way that they choose in their forest, and that's their right and it must be respected.
I suppose for most people, when we imagine these tribes people, we imagine someone almost living in the ways of cave people, but presumably that's not the case. Presumably they have had exposure in some way to some modern technologies, perhaps not computers, but tools and so on.
Yeah, there are all sorts of prejudiced misconceptions about uncontacted tribes. You know, people calling them primitive, calling them savage, calling them stuck in the Stone Age, all sorts of things. And of course, first of all, none of that is true, because they are modern societies just like the rest of us. We're all here living in the here and now at the same time. It's just that they're living in a different way. And secondly, that's beyond being false, extremely dangerous, because that sort of lingo, that sort of vision that some people like to portray of uncontacted tribes is exactly the sort of thing that plays right into the hands of the people who want to steal their territories, governments, companies. And there are some people, including some anthropologists, who claim that controlled contact, they call it controlled contact, must be made with uncontacted tribes to bring them into what they call the modern world. As I say, first of all, that doesn't make any sense, because all of us are already in the same world. But also, there's no such thing as controlled contact. You can't make contact with these people in any safe way. We've seen time and again, and in fact, Brazilian experts from the government, from the Indigenous Affairs Department, FUNAI, changed their policy. It used to be one of making contact during the military dictatorship and beyond. And in 1987, they changed their government policy to being one of respecting land rights and protecting land so that uncontacted tribes can live in the way they choose instead of making contact. And that is because they saw that forced contact made by outsiders is likely to kill many uncontacted people, if not wipe out the whole tribe. and it just can't happen.
Because of viruses and the sort of diseases that these tribes haven't been exposed to because they don't live in our dirtier version of the world?
Yes. Yeah, they have very little immunity to outside diseases. A common cold or a flu could kill them. And of course, now during the pandemic, that's a very big worry. And with the skyrocketing levels of invasions of indigenous territories in Brazil, for example, including uncontacted territories, that's a big worry, you know, that the invaders could be transporting COVID and other things with them. And also because of violence, disease and violence, those are the two biggest lethal factors involved here. Violence in terms of land grabbers going into these territories and seeing uncontacted tribes as an inconvenience, an obstacle to profit, to big profit that they can make quickly by cutting down the last valuable remaining hardwoods in these forests, or by exploring for gas and oil or mining and other things.
Can you tell us what we do know about these tribes in terms of how they live and what they know about their forest? I mean, it's, as you say, it's not fair to think of them as sort of relics from the past, but I'm trying to imagine what it would be like to be so unburdened with the modern issues of the day, what emails I'm going to have, making sure I have the groceries, paying my taxes and these sort of things. I'm wondering what the lives of uncontacted tribes people result in terms of behavior, understanding of their areas, their interests and so on.
Yeah, well, they're the best guardians of their forests, aren't they? And you see that where uncontacted tribes live, especially in areas where their lands are relatively well protected at the borders by governments, even though that's a topic we can come to, and in many cases that's not happening, but where their lands are relatively well protected at the borders, these territories are islands of green amid seas of deforestation all around them. And that is proof, not that we needed it because we knew already, but that is visual proof that uncontacted tribes live in harmony with nature. They protect it better than anybody else can. They know their lands and their forests inside out. They know which plants to use for medicinal purposes and which ones not to use because they're poisonous. They know which plants to use for house building and everything that they need, basically. Hunting, fishing, everything. And of course, we can get an insight into this sort of thing from their contacted relatives and neighbors. I've spent time in the Amazon with lots of indigenous people who live not too far away from uncontacted tribes, and they've explained how uncontacted tribes would live. And for example, Rita Piripkura, she's the only contacted person of the Piripkura tribe. The others are uncontacted. And that's one key case that we're working on at the moment, actually, within the Uncontacted Tribes campaign, because there's an emergency land protection order on that territory, which was due to expire. So we've been campaigning nonstop with several other organizations on that question. But Rita Piripkura, I spent some time with her in her forest, and you know, you walk around the forest and she can explain exactly what each plant is and where each you could find each type of fish, for example. It's incredible. It's really inspirational.
As a presenter of a program that sort of celebrates knowledge, I'm thinking of the treasure trove of understanding that anthropologists, I'm sure, across the world would love to be able to have conversations and try and understand thinkings and even simple tests based on nature and nurture. You know, there's so much you could explore from a scientific point of view. That's, I suppose, one of the sacrifices that we have to make to protect these tribes, because by trying to do that, presumably we both put them in danger from a disease point of view, but there's also a worry that they may change the way they live. Is that a concern as well? What happens, or what has happened historically, to those contacted tribespeople where anthropologists have been able to talk and learn from them?
Well, I mean, first of all, I'd say that any reason or suggested reason to go and make contact with uncontacted tribes is not a good reason. and you know, there's nothing that can justify forcing something on a whole people that could wipe them out. Hmm. Whether that be for the sake of science, whether that be for the sake of any studies, as you mentioned, or whether that be for the sake of healthcare or education, as some people argue, nothing at all can justify going and making forced contact with people who show that they don't want it, when we know that they could all be killed as a result. Obviously, also, we know that they have their own healthcare systems and they have their own education systems. But I think that, of course, we can learn a lot without going and making contact with uncontacted tribes, as I said, from their contacted neighbors and governments monitoring their land and information that can come out of that without making contact.
What are local governments doing to protect these tribes people, and how big is it on the agenda? Because obviously there is a cost associated with policing, monitoring and protecting what could be a very valuable natural resource, as we've seen in other parts of the Amazon, for example.
Yeah, well, we've got a lot of work on our hands, don't we? Because on the whole, governments aren't respecting the rights of uncontacted tribes. These are rights that are enshrined into national constitutions and also into international law in the form of Convention 169 of the International Labour Organization, which upholds indigenous peoples, including uncontacted tribes, right to own their land and to live on their land in the way that they choose. Governments aren't respecting that. Governments obviously have different interests. And companies as well. And in the case of Brazil, for example, at the moment, President Bolsonaro has basically declared war on indigenous peoples and has implemented a whole series of genocidal actions and proposals with the aim of stealing indigenous territories, knowing that, of course, these are the territories with the most biodiversity on the planet, and that therefore big bucks can be made from them. Mm. And uncontacted tribes among all of these indigenous territories are almost always the most sought after, because they are the ones with the resources, natural resources, best kept. So invasions are skyrocketing, as I said, left, right and center on uncontacted tribes territories. In the Yanomami territory, for example, the contacted Yanomami have warned of more than 20,000 illegal gold miners in that territory. Got the Piripcura territory that I mentioned before, the Awa in the northeastern Brazilian Amazon, where loggers are reinvading, and cattle ranchers as well. And the list goes on. And in other countries as well, like in Peru, for example, the government is really dragging its heels in terms of protecting uncontacted tribes territories. There are four territories still awaiting protection, even on paper. I mean, the good news that we've had recently was that two uncontacted tribes territories in Peru, after lots of pressure from the indigenous movement in Peru and their allies around the world, including Survival, two of those territories were protected on paper. They call them uncontacted tribes reserves in Peru. But there are four which have not been on paper, let alone in practice. Same in Paraguay, the uncontacted Ayoreo Toto Viego Sode, their land has been taken over by agribusiness. So their contacted relatives and their allies are campaigning for the government to give that land back to the uncontacted people and to the Ayoreo more generally.
Yeah, it's depressing, really, the interests and how they can affect even the most pristine areas for animals as well as people. What can people who are listening do, Sarah, if they want to protect these areas? Is there something they should do as tourists or as consumers or as activists?
Yeah, I think we all have a part to play. I think, as I said, this isn't just a matter for a select group of people, it's really a matter for everybody, first of all, because we're all involved. I mean, the destruction of uncontacted tribes territories is being fueled by global demand for wood, for gold, for all sorts of things, petrol. And also just from a moral point of view, really, as well, you know, in terms of allowing the richness of humanity to survive. I think we've all got a part to play in that. And I'd really encourage people to get involved. There's all sorts of campaign actions that people can take. If you go to our website, survivalinternational.org, on our social media channels as well, we're very active on many different cases of uncontacted tribes at the moment, including some of the ones that I've mentioned already. And also, of course, you can follow Indigenous organizations and people on social media. That's a really interesting part of the fight as well. There's tribal voice videos. These are videos of contacted Indigenous people talking about their uncontacted relatives. Those are on our social media and our website as well, and people can watch them and hear straight from their mouths, which is much more interesting than hearing from me.
Well, it's really interesting speaking with you, Sarah Schenker, who's Senior Research and Advocacy Officer at Survival International. Thank you so much for your time.
Thank you very much.
It's mad to think that there are people who live without phones, without any understanding of social media or AI or just the normal things we take for granted in modern life. In a way, it seems like a paradise, doesn't it? If you want to see photographs or video of these uncontracted tribes, by the way, there's some amazing footage taken from drones that we were talking about. You can see it in our Twitter page. It's at News Talk Science. Right, time to look back at some of your comments from last week, as we do. We were speaking about motherhood, and someone said, thoroughly enjoy that piece on mothers from a multitasking house husband cleaning the home while listening to his favourite science show. Well, you're very welcome. A really interesting piece about the physical and psychosocial changes that happen when a woman becomes a mother. We were also speaking to Professor Marcus de Sautoy, who is a mathematician with a new book out called Shortcuts, all about the shortcuts people take in maths and the sort of shortcuts we can take in life too. Granny Smith says the shortcut of adding all the numbers from 1 to 100 and beyond is a life-changing experience for me. Yeah, this is a really simple challenge. So if I asked you to add all the numbers from 1 to 100, and you might take a long time to do that, or you might take the shortcut, which is to add 1 to 99, and that's 100, 2 to 98, and that's 100, and you'll end up with 5,050, I think the answer is, which is a much quicker way of doing it than having to add all the numbers together. And that works for, obviously, larger numbers as well. So that was one of the shortcuts that Marcus mentioned. Porik says, great interview. We'll definitely check out the book. Keep up the great work. Thanks very much, that Porik. And we were also speaking to a guy called Nathan Murtold, who's a sort of a guru on so-called metamaterials. And these are a sort of complex synthetic materials that can do more than just natural materials can. So we were talking about micro ones and macro ones, some that actually might help in erosion and everything. Really interesting piece. But Conrad emailed us in saying, I'm from Ireland but live in Silicon Valley, listen to your show regularly, didn't know that Nathan was planning to be on, even more surprised, made it even more enjoyable because we just launched a venture fund on metamaterials. And of course, no, Nathan. Very cool. Thanks, Conrad. And finally, someone was listening to an older episode, Harriet Carroll. It was a 2018 episode about the anus with Andreas Heinol. And in it, he says, the flatworm Thysanosine nigra papillosum has multiple anuses protruding from its back, unlike some slacker phyla we could mention who are only bothered with one. So that was from the podcast. Harriet says, I wanted to use this as a daily fun fact, but couldn't find a reliable source for it. If anyone has a link, that would be great. Well, it will be in our podcast on Tuesday. I think we're a reputable source to cite, are we not? And Andreas Heinol would know. We are going to be playing it again on Tuesday, so listen out for it in our Futureproof Gold episode. That's it from us for this week's programme. Hope you enjoyed it. Thanks to producing Aidan McKelvey and the team, Simon Keane, Garrett Mahal and Steve McClune on sound. We'll be back with more Futureproof on Tuesday with that episode on anuses. In the meantime, stay curious.